WHUR FM and HD1 Washington, giving you an HUR at Home and Daily Drum Special Edition. Young, gifted, and frisked. Harold Fisher speaks to our youth now.
Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of the Daily Drum on WHUR and SiriusXM, Channel 141, and all of our social media platforms. I'm Harold Fisher. The title of our program tonight is Young, Gifted, and Frisked. It's an examination of what appears to be a resurgence of police stop and frisk policies across the nation. This was last part of a national conversation when former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg ran for president. But now the issue is back in the form of uncomfortable interaction with police and young Black men and teenagers. And just last week, the DC ACLU released a report saying stop and frisk tactics used by the Metropolitan Police Department are racially biased. More than 70% of stops made by DC police between July and December of last year were of Black people. But African Americans make up only 47% of the population. Well, tonight, my guests are Dr. Robert Wingfield, Chief Psychologist and Clinic Director for Boys Town, Washington, D.C., Kishelle Coleman, Executive Director for Boys Town in Washington, D.C., Juwala Lloyd, he's a 25-year-old security guard who has had run-ins with D.C. police, and Ayize Sabater, 24-year-old student at Morgan State University. You can certainly tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Thank you all for joining this important conversation. I appreciate it. Ayize, I want to start with you. Talk to me briefly about your encounter with police.
All right. I've had a few different encounters with police, some good, some not so good. And I guess one that's really two that's in the forefront of my mind was one when I was really younger. Somebody had broke into my father's car, and when we came back, we were trying to figure out what was taken from the car and things of that nature. And some police, I guess, had stopped by. I guess somebody called the police thinking that we were the ones stealing from the car. And when they came, like, they almost pulled a gun on my brother. My dad was like it was a whole long process just to try and, explain, this was our car. Somebody had broken in. And so on. And then a second one that's like on the forefront of my mind was maybe a few years ago when actually it was in Baltimore County, like Towson area. And I was actually at a graduation party at Towson, and apparently a fight had broken out across the street at a predominantly white area. And when the party that I was at let out, I guess some type of altercation happened, and like in a matter of minutes, police were all over the place, pepper spraying people, had the canines out. My friend got assaulted, and when that happened, like I tried to step in, and then and I got taken down too. So it's been some good, again, like I said, and some not so good. So those are just experiences I've had.
You have some interesting thoughts about why young Black men are having difficulty with police, considering our climate, particularly as it relates to trust. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I feel like with a lot of human interactions, it goes both ways. So for on the police side of things, a lot of times, they come with a preconceived idea that they may be conscious of or subconsciously, and that kind of drives the interaction a certain way. And then on the civilian side, being a Black man, dealing with that can definitely be infuriating. So it's just learning how to try and manage your stress and control and having a certain level of self-control, because it definitely is like really annoying and just frustrating to be, you know, to be stopped for very, very minuscule reasons or very things that are not even that much of an issue. And so I feel like if both sides could learn how to try and manage or navigate through those emotions, I feel like it could drive to more positive experiences.
Juwalo, you also had a rather fascinating interaction with police on YouTube a while back. Talk to me about that.
So this indication on U Street was one that I questioned for a long time, because it was a fight that had broke out on U Street, 14th and U, and I'm also an entertainer, so I'm around all of that at the same time. So going back to my vehicle, I was stopped by a police officer, a Caucasian police officer, and he was asking me questions that I didn't have answers for. So he took my... He took my answers as, and he took my non-answering as being disrespectful, and decided he thought he was going to put his hands on me. And I feel like, what are you putting your hands on me for? So I'm asking him questions, but also resisting. Not pushing, just resisting. Then two other officers came. They don't know what's going on. They just feel like they should come and attack me. I'm standing my ground. Not pushing, just resisting. What's the problem, officer? Oh, you have a problem with this officer. Now you have a problem with me. But they don't even know what's going on. At the end of it, they tell me that they were looking for somebody who had gotten into a fight. It's a black guy walking down the street with a tank top on. Mind you, it's hot outside. It's summertime. I'm chilling. I'm walking to my car. My shirt is literally in my hand. I'm walking to my car. And I think that night I went to jail for like 2 nights. And I was in process until 24 hours. And I just got sent home with no charges.
What do you think about that?
Confused, very confused of why it happens. I don't know. It also goes back to how the police system was created in the first place. And the things that they're doing is not even really confusing. It's just they're trying to tell us lies that we already know. And they're trying to cover it up by, oh, we're here for the people. But you're not, though. You know what you became a police officer for, and it's really confusing for the little kids that's growing up seeing police officers, because now we're not even going to respect the people who are in our own skin defending our city. And now we're attacking people who are pure and not even attacking the people who are not. We just have to... It's a lot that goes into this. It's not even the police system. It's the government. It's the congressional system. I think that's what it's called. It's what we do behind closed doors that affect what we see in the open. And that's just my take on it. I'll be going a lot of places, but I'm confused. But not really, because I know, but I don't.
Dr. Wingfield, talk to me about what you're hearing from Juwalo after undergoing this incident with police. Obviously, he wasn't physically hurt, but there is still trauma involved with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, I applaud both young men for being willing and courageous enough to express their stories. This is the reason. This is one of the reasons why I agreed to be on this segment, because I know that these things happen and more light needs to be shed on this topic. And these men, these young men represent stories that can go back many, many decades, and it continues in, you know, in 2020. And the stress that's related to having these interactions with police really accumulate over time to make us physically sick. The body is not designed to operate within chronic distress. Acute distress can be fine. In fact, acute distress can be helpful, but when it's long-term, the end result is the body eventually turning on itself. The immune system is affected, and we as Black men have to think about so many things before we even step out of the house. And so what these young men are describing really has an effect on how they can concentrate, maybe at work, maybe to prepare for a test. They are dealing with additional burdens that other groups of people don't have to deal with. Even to go on a job interview, you can't just MapQuest destination B, you know, start point A, destination B, 30 minutes. Okay, I'm going to leave out an hour early so I can get to 30 minutes early. You actually have to estimate time for DWB, a driving while black, because you know there's a higher probability that somebody is going to assume, a police officer is going to assume, that because you are a black male, you are a criminal, and it's up to the black male to prove that he's not a criminal. I got my license in 1998. I really didn't understand why there was such concern about prejudice and discrimination until I got my driver's license. And that's when a whole series of driving while blacks occurred at 16 years old, even to now. And it's, you have to present yourself in a way to prove that you're not a criminal. That is wrong. And it's filled with all the things that we know from social psychology, such as confirmation bias, stereotypes, assumptions that are then not challenged with the reality that most of us are good people, good citizens. We actually give back to our communities and we want the same kind of treatment. It is not a inconvenience for others. It should not be an inconvenience for others to treat us in an equitable fashion.
Ms. Coleman, you know, one of the overarching issues that Dr. Wingfield has mentioned and that the two young men have discussed have to do with interaction with police. And at, you know, at Boys Town, when you're talking about kind of, you know, providing services, social skills and the like, talk to me a little bit about some of the stopgap measures that you do there for helping young men with the talk, as we say, how to deal with police. You know, certainly fathers, yes, and even mothers have had that conversation with their children, but not all children have the benefit of that. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, just based on the things that I've just heard from the two young men, one saying having to be able to manage their emotions when dealing, you know, facing the cops and, you know, asking questions and standing your ground. So for me, my perspective as a mother and as an administrator from a youth care organization, the main word that comes to my mind is preparation. We have to prepare our young black men for what they're going out into this world. So within our program, we do teach social skills and we try to get them to generalize those skills so that when they leave our campus day to day and when they leave our program. And so when it comes to the talk, you know, while I understand when they're in those situations, it's not right. We know it's not right. However, we also know it's our reality. And so it's my goal to make sure that we are preparing them. And so it becomes part of a skill we have to teach them and how to interact with the police and how to get back home alive. That is the most important thing. When you're in that moment, it's not right, but you can't control what they're doing. And so we want to prepare young men to, you know, just be in control of their own self and their own emotions. And so we get very specific in terms of what does that look like? You know, are you going to ask questions and talk at that moment? No. Where are your hands going to be? Where are your eyes going to be focused on? And yes, we want you to stand your ground, but we want you to make it home alive. And then when you get back, we can talk about those experiences. We can help you to problem solve. And better yet, we can focus on skills that's going to help you learn how to advocate for yourself in an environment and in a way that we hope that will affect change. And so I think today, in the wake of you know, George Floyd's death, even as an administrator, I'm thinking, what are we forgetting? What else do we need to talk about? What other skills do we need to teach? And so in our program, you know, it's important, and we mandate that they have family meetings daily. And I encourage this in our own homes now. We've got to get back to that sense of community. We got to get back to that sense of family. And we can't be afraid to have these tough conversations with our kids. We've got to talk about racism. We've got to talk about violence. We've got to talk about justice, and we have to prepare our kids how to deal with these things. Because even if we don't say it, they're experiencing it. These kids are coming to us. They see police snatching their moms out of their homes, snatching them out of their homes. They're being pulled over. They're seeing it in so many different ways, and they don't understand it. And we don't want them to just learn from that perspective. We want to have say-so on how they understand what they're experiencing and how they can get through it.
This is a special edition of The Daily Drum, Young, Gifted, and Frisked, an examination of the resurgence of police stop and frisk policies across the nation. You're certainly invited to join this conversation on Facebook or on Instagram or on WHUR. We certainly invite you to comment. And if you post your comment, we will certainly ask the question or repeat your comment as you write it in. I want to ask Aize, you know, how does it feel when it seems that, you know, with all the correction that you're doing as, you know, as a Black man, and not much correction is directed towards police? Why is it that, you know, certainly you want to be on the straight and narrow, but why can't it go both ways? Did you hear the question?
I heard the pieces.
Yeah, I was saying. As Black men, we always have to make sure that we are doing, you know, the absolute right thing, whether it's driving, walking, sleeping, breathing, eating, etc. Okay, but why not? Do you find it a difficult proposition to have police address their behavior? Were you able to hear my question? I think we may have lost his connection.
Yes.
Go right ahead. Did you hear my question? Did you hear my? Well, let me ask Juwalo. Did you hear the question? Yeah. Please turn your microphone on. I think your microphone is off, Juwalo. Thank you. Please.
I did hear the question, but I might need you to ask it one more time.
Sure. You know, obviously, in your case, when you were having that interaction with police, you were just walking down the street, minding your own business. You were trying to get home, okay? And yet you had a confrontation with police. And the issue, at least I would imagine for you, is not that you were doing anything wrong, but that, you know, that the police, the actions of the police were not correct. Do you have an issue with the fact that you have to act right, but they don't?
I have an issue with the oppressors. It's not the police system. It's the belief of the police system. You ask me that question, because it's like a thousand things that go, it's not nothing that I'm doing wrong. I was literally about to fix my hair before I came on here. I was like, no, I'm not about to fix my hair, because this is what they have a problem with. Mm. Our beauty is what they have a problem with. So I'm not going to change what I'm doing, because I'm not doing anything wrong. We have to know that it's right and wrong. There's no such thing. It's good and evil. That's where we live in right now. We are in a spiritual warfare. And it's karma coming back from everything that they have done. It's never nothing that we're doing wrong. They just trying to manipulate us, and we're not having it no more. It's the things that we have. It's nothing ever that we're doing wrong. Michael Max didn't do nothing wrong. Rosa Parks didn't do nothing wrong.
Dr. Wingfield, your comment about that.
Well, he is, in a way, taking some of what Dr. King talked about in the letter from Birmingham City Jail, when he was talking about a just law versus an unjust law. And he talked about the different levels of law, positive law, a man-created law must be embedded within natural law. Natural law must be embedded within eternal law. Eternal law is identical to the mind of God. So when he talks about this being spiritual warfare, he's on point. This is a battle between living out what our Creator has designed us to be and to live. Life is sacred. And for the event that took place with Mr. George Floyd, we were all alarmed and very disturbed. Why? Because we know this is out of the order, the natural order, the eternal order, and even the laws say that this is wrong. Now, we must ask, why is it that we still have doubt about whether he's going to be convicted? We have doubt because of the systems. The systems have the policies, have the mechanisms that protect individuals who commit acts of violence and commit evil, racist behavior, like an inequitable police practice that is targeting a group of individuals, represents evil if the end result is death. So the systems must come into play during the conversations, because that officer has a supervisor who has a supervisor who has a supervisor. Let's ask this question. What if not only the officer who killed the Black man went to prison, but his superiors, and who's in his superior? Guess what? We will see a drop in the number of Black lives lost in the hands of police, because they're going to be trained differently, because now the consequences don't just fall on the people who are actively encountering the citizens, but also those superiors who are responsible for the training. So as we look at the big picture, we must put all the pieces together. And there are some good officers. I have friends who are great officers, and I know that they do everything they can do in their role, but we need to support those good officers in many ways and make sure that they are protected when they are whistleblowers, because some of them are not. Some of them whistleblow, they get transferred. They whistleblow, they get demoted. They whistleblow, now they might not be able to feed their kids. So it's a punishment for living out honesty. And we need to protect the good officers too. I rally around the good officers. I love you all. We need you all. But the community needs the service to be the priority.
Want to add something to that?
Sure, please do.
All right, so I definitely agree with a lot of the stuff that was said, and to kind of add to the idea of reform, there's something that Fred Hampton had said about when people who were looking to join, like, the Black Panthers, they said that they would do a political education kind of training camp that they had people who were looking to join in a certain time. But one of the things that I took away from what he was saying was how education is probably one of the most important things in a lot of these systems. And if we can start trying to change these systems by helping to change the individuals, because once you change how they think, how they're educated, then we can really start having the system to change. And I feel like I definitely agree. Maybe having a much better educational system or program put in place for people who are becoming officers or looking to become officers, because I believe it more times than not, it's not very much requirements needed to be an officer, and it's not very much training that's going into it, whether it be like, it should be psychological training that goes into it, stress training that goes into it, you know, teaching individuals on a larger scale, you know, making sure that those things are being implemented. Because like you said, you have, like, I have an uncle that's an officer as well, and he's a great person, but that's because he as an individual is a good person. So I feel like once we start changing the individuals and better educating ourselves and those individuals, that we can really change those systems.
And I think what you're referring to, and we've heard this term a lot when it comes to policing, cultural competency. In other words, understanding the communities that you are serving and that you are patrolling. And as we have seen, for example, in the District of Columbia, we've also seen that, for example, in Baltimore. On my street here in Baltimore, there's a police officer who lives two doors up. But that is unusual because, for example, in Washington, D.C., many of the officers don't live in the district. They live out in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Some of them are coming from communities that are not familiar with Washington. And sometimes those things may contribute to clashes. You seem as if you want to share something, Ms. Coleman, because I saw you kind of nodding your head real quick. If you have a chance to add to the conversation before I go to the break in about 5 minutes.
Yes, I think it really is about, well, a couple of comments that I wanted to say is, one is about the culture in the police department, right? So it's not all police. There are some inherently good, but again, they're not going to speak up if there's repercussions on them. And so we do have to look at that culture. We also have to get back to that sense of community and have them involved in the community. Most of our young people experiences with the police is negative, and it doesn't have to be all the time. And I think, you know, I know for me as an administrator, and I'm thinking now, or what are ways we can do to bring the police on our campus, to get to know our kids, to see who they are as individuals, not the color of their skin, not their reputation that if they're in this program, they inherently are bad, but they're just kids, you know what I mean, who wants a better life, and that's why they're there. And so I think we need to, you know, those that are in positions to have an impact, we really need to think through how do we bring that community back together and make the police department an active part of that community. At Boys Town, when our kids do something that's inappropriate, we don't call the police on them. There are a lot of areas or programs or scenarios where if a kid does wrong, the police gets called. And so police are seen as an intervention for kids when they're doing wrong. Well, police were designed to, or they're said to protect and serve. So there's a contradiction there. If they're supposed to protect and serve, why are they only coming in as an intervention when a kid is supposedly doing something wrong? There's a problem right there with that message. And so how do we get past this and really do things that lives up to what the police are supposed to be, and that is to protect and serve? And if you're going to protect and serve, usually if we have a sense of belonging, if they feel like they're a part of this community, maybe they will protect and serve. But if you're just coming from your own community to come here to make, you know, one culture feel comfortable, then the other culture, you know, there's going to be a problem. And I think it's just set up. It, that's why we're having the problems we're having.
Doctor, I've got about a minute before I go to a break. Give me one big takeaway for you when you're talking about young Black men interacting with police.
We need more empathy, more understanding. There is a deleterious deficiency of meaningful empathy. Why is this? Because there are narratives about why Black men struggle that need to be confronted, because these narratives are not accurate. They represent intellectual dishonesty. The majority of Black men have families who they want to take care of. They want to be seen as men. It's very important to understand the mind of a man. A man wants to provide. A man wants to protect. A godly man wants to be the priest of his home. A man wants to be a leader. If you're speaking to another individual who's a man and he wants to be these things, it is very difficult to stay calm because of your identity as a man, as a leader. You want to speak up for yourself because you are responsible for speaking up for your family. So you have to speak up for yourself. But then also, I think about the mental health. A lot of times, men, starting with young boys, they get diagnosed with things like conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder. They actually have anxiety disorder or major depression disorder.
Doctor, I need you to hold that point because I've got to take a break, but I don't want you to forget that point. And I also want to remind our listeners and our viewers that you can hear this in every WHUR Daily Drum discussion via podcast on WHUR.com. It's posted before 9 p.m. every night. Please stay with us.